Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Boral Limited FY 2021 results call for the financial community. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I'd now like to turn the call over to Zlatko Tripljevski, CEO and Managing Director. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Ari, and good morning, and thank you for joining us. I'm talking to you from the Southern Highlands of New South Wales today, which is Tharawal land. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from which we're all joining this meeting today. We recognize and respect all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and their unique position in Australian culture and history, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. Today, I'll provide a brief overview of Boral's full-year result to 30 June 2021, and then Tino Laspina, Boral's Chief Finance and Strategy Officer, will take you through some of the detail of the result and the group's financial framework. I'll then provide a strategy update, an overview of our key priorities, and our view of trading conditions for FY 2022. At the end, we'll open up to Q&A. We're providing this update while we're in lockdown, so obviously all in different locations. The slides I'll refer to are on our website or on the ASX platform, so as we refer to particular slides, I'll let you know which page we're on. Turning first to our strategy highlights for the year on slide three. We've made significant progress to deliver on our strategy to transform Boral and reset the portfolio so that we can sustainably deliver better results and build a stronger business. Towards the end of the presentation, I'll focus more on our new strategy, which has four pillars defined as focus, position, redefine, and extend. Over the past year, we've divested several non-core assets, including our 50% interest in the USG Boral joint venture, and we've entered into an agreement to sell the North American building products business. Both transactions were struck at sale prices well above expectations. Both the sale of the building products business in the U.S. and the U.S. Meridian Brick joint venture are yet to complete but are well progressed. Following a detailed assessment of strategic options for our North American fly ash business, we're also now entering the final stages of the divestment of this business. We've recently announced the sale of Boral's Australian timber business, and we also have plans to divest the East Coast roofing and masonry business, which would mark our complete exit from Australian building products. We've articulated a financial framework and established a transformation target that underpins this objective. Central to our thinking is that Boral needs to be a company that delivers return on funds employed greater than our weighted average cost of capital, irrespective of the economic cycle we find ourselves in. Tino will cover the framework later in the presentation. With our net debt sitting at the lower end of the target range, our financial framework is already supporting a stronger balance sheet. In Australia, our new operating model became effective on the 1st of July, and we have a new leadership team supporting the turnaround. The operating model sees our Australian business moving from a siloed regional business to a much more integrated operating company organized along national product lines. This will make it easier for our customers to work with us and should enable us to create significant value, including supporting effective delivery of the transformation objectives. Turning to slide four, our financial highlights for FY 2021. We've split our continuing operations from our total operations with Boral North America, our interest in USG Boral, and the Australian building products business represented as discontinued operations. Looking at some of the key numbers on a total operations basis, net profit after tax of 251 million before significant items was up 44% compared with the prior year, helped by transformation initiatives and a stronger contribution from North America. Statutory profit after tax of 640 million reflects a post-tax gain of 389 million from significant items and primarily relates to the profit on sale of Boral's 50% interest in the USG Boral joint venture, as well as the Midland Brick business. Return on funds employed for total operations improved to 7.4% from 4.3% in the prior year. But we're focused on return on funds employed for continuing operations, excluding property, considering property earnings can vary from year to year. At 7.2% excluding property, We still have a long way to go before return on funds employed is at an acceptable level, but I'm pleased with the year-on-year improvement of almost a full percentage point. The decision to not pay a final dividend reflects the fact that there was no surplus capital available to return to shareholders beyond the share buyback we completed last month. However, following receipt of proceeds from announced divestments, we will have a significant surplus of capital, which will be available for reinvestment and to return to shareholders. In our continuing operations, the benefits of our transformation program supported earnings. While revenues declined by 6%, EBIT excluding property increased 11% to $157 million. Having delivered $69 million of transformation benefits for continuing operations within the year, these initiatives represent an annualised run rate benefit after inflation of $94 million against the $200 to $250 million target we've set. Moving now to page 5, zero harm is our priority. We've done a lot of work on our health and safety approach, particularly focusing on the risk of serious harm. This year, we've reported serious harm injury frequency rate on both an actual and a potential basis. Pleasingly, we've seen a 67% reduction in the frequency rate of actual serious harm and a 53% reduction in potential serious harm. This reflects implementation of a number of programs that focus on critical controls, as well as identifying and preventing incidents that cause serious harm. Unfortunately, Boral's recordable injury frequency rate has increased to 11.9, and our attention is focused on improving those outcomes, particularly around manual handling risks and vehicle and pedestrian interaction. As a business, efforts to minimise the risk of spreading COVID-19 to keep our people, customers and communities safe remains a priority. A huge amount of work is continuing to take place in this area. In New South Wales, COVID safe plans are in place for all of our sites in line with the New South Wales government requirements. We've shifted from focusing on social distancing and hygiene, which is the norm today, to supporting our people around mental health, focusing on vaccination rates, and considering other tools that protect our people and provide confidence in the construction sector more broadly. This year, we've also started to report serious environmental incident frequency rate, which for Boral Australia was 0.3 in FY21, a solid improvement on the prior year. Boral Australia received no penalty infringement notices during the year, which is the first time this has occurred in at least 8 years. Turning to our market segment review on slide 6 and 7. During FY21, underlying market activity was mixed. In Australia, the value of work completed in the roads, highways, subdivisions and bridges segment decreased by about 3%, with the decline more pronounced in New South Wales. The value of work completed for other engineering was also soft, falling by around 7%, with activity falling in all states. Non-residential activity declined around 5% as commercial office and retail sectors were heavily impacted by uncertainty around post-pandemic demand. Boral's major projects, which can include roads, highways, subdivisions and bridges, other engineering and non-residential construction, were substantially lower in FY21, a trend that was continued since we called this out in February at our half-year results. Major projects revenue, including concrete placing, contributed 10% of Boral Australia's revenue, compared with 17% in the prior year. This reflects a heightened level of activity in the prior year, with several large projects in New South Wales and Queensland finishing in FY20 and early FY21. This is coupled with current project work being at a less materials intensive stage, representing less than 3% of the value of work in FY21, compared with more than 5% in FY20. Consequently, Boral's project revenue in New South Wales and Queensland was down 63% and 52% respectively. While we continue to bid for infrastructure work, projects remain slow to move to execution phase, particularly in Queensland. Turning to the residential sector now, which is a segment we're less exposed to. Australian housing starts increased 16% to an estimated 201,000 starts in the year. However, on a value of work done basis, Australian housing activity was actually down by an estimated 1%. Detached housing starts increased by 32%, underpinned by government stimulus, while the value of work done in detached housing was only up 7%. Multi-residential starts were down 6%, reflecting continued impact by the pause in immigration, with value of work done in multi-residential down 12%. While Boral benefited from growth in residential starts, the increase in starts was more pronounced where Boral's presence is smaller. For example, New South Wales housing starts increased by 6,000 in the year, or 11%, while Western Australia increased by 10,000, or 73%, with WA representing 36% of Australia's increased housing starts in the year. In FY21, 43% of Boral's revenue was derived from New South Wales, while only 5% was derived from WA. I'll now hand you over to Tino, who'll take you through the financial performance and the financial framework.
Thanks, Lutko, and good morning, everyone. Turning to the group's financial performance on page 9, if we look at the total operations, the group's revenue is down 7% on prior year. On the earnings front, the group's EBIT is up 37% on prior year, with the benefits of our transformation program and the stronger performance from North America offsetting the revenue shortfall. This drove an increase of 44% in net profit after tax of $251 million. Throughout this presentation, we're going to primarily focus on continuing operations. So turning to continuing operations in more detail on page 10, we saw revenue decline due to mixed market conditions. Lower demand from infrastructure and major projects, as well as weakness in multi-residential and non-residential construction, was only partially offset by growth in detached housing and the alterations and additions segment. Prices were also softer across the business, with prices bottoming out in this second half. As previously noted, several key projects in New South Wales and Queensland completed in FY20 and in the first half of FY21. We continue to experience project delays due to various reasons outside our control. The lower materials intensity of major projects also led to contraction in the value of work done, as large projects in FY21 were driven by tunnelling works, utilities realignment, or road fit-out and finishing works. Excluding property, earnings grew 11%, reflecting $69 million of net transformation benefits, which helped to offset the impact of lower volumes, softer prices, and an adverse mix shift. ROFE, excluding property, improved 90 basis points on the prior year. However, the performance highlights that there's more to do on transformation. Looking at the earnings waterfall on page 11, the impact of the decline in volumes and price is evident, with a net $77 million unfavourable volume impact and a $29 million unfavourable pricing variance. The volume decline reflected a 3% reduction in concrete and 4% reduction in quarry volumes. This is primarily the result of lower major project activity, as well as market-driven declines in multi-res and non-residential activity, again, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland. We also saw the flow-through of lower selling prices from the prior period. However, we did see the average selling prices for quarry materials benefit from a more favourable product mix. Pleasingly, the business delivered $119 million of gross transformation benefits, or $69 million of benefits net of inflation, which helps to mitigate the impact of lower volumes. As highlighted, we've seen a $51 million reversal of prior year COVID impacts, together with the benefit of lower D&A, which was partially offset by one-off items, including a kiln outage and elevated legal costs. Property earnings were $31 million lower than the prior year. The sale of our Alexandria property was the primary contributor in FY21. What's most evident from the waterfall is the fact that our transformation program has protected the bottom line during a period in which we've experienced significant top-line headwinds. Through our transformation program, we have permanently reduced the cost base, and the business is well positioned to gain the benefits of operating leverage in a cyclical upturn. Slide 12 looks at the EBIT decline associated with the reduction in volume. I won't go through the market dynamics, as Leco has already outlined the major movements. As Boral derives nearly 70% of its revenue from the roads, highways, subdivisions and bridges and other engineering and non-residential, it comes as no surprise that the contraction in major projects and RHS&B contributed to the vast majority of the EBIT decline attributed to volumes. While detached housing and alterations and addition segment volume contribution is positive, we're just less exposed to these segments. Many of you will be familiar with our financial framework. For those that are not, I'll briefly recap. So on page 14, starting from the bottom, the group targets TSR in the top quartile of the ASX 100. To achieve this, we seek to generate EPS growth in the top quartile of the ASX 100. And the framework is underpinned by three core pillars. First, maintaining an optimal capital structure. Simply put, having the right amount of debt for our business. The optimal net debt range is where Boral's cost of capital is at its lowest. Ensuring return on funds employed, or ROFE, is greater than our cost of capital. At Boral, we're targeting ROFE greater than 10% throughout the cycle. At this level, we believe we'll exceed the group's cost of capital. Third, being disciplined about how we allocate our capital. If we maintain an optimal capital structure and achieve ROFE greater than WACC, we will generate surplus capital. How we allocate that capital will drive our success. We'll reinvest in the business to ensure we maintain a sustainable competitive advantage. We have divested assets where we do not have a sustainable competitive advantage, and we will return any surplus to our shareholders in the most efficient form. On page 15, our optimal capital structure is defined by the point where our cost of capital is at its lowest. For Boral, this is 2 to 2.5 times net debt to EBITDA where ROFE equals WACC. We will target the bottom end of the range to ensure we retain flexibility at cyclical lows. For continuing operations, Boral's optimal net debt range is $900 to $1.1 billion. At 30 June 2021, Boral's net debt was $900 million, which is at the bottom end of the range. Importantly, Boral maintains strong liquidity of about $1.35 billion, including more than $900 million in cash. We also have undrawn committed banking facilities of $450 million. And with a weighted average debt maturity of 4.9 years, there's minimal refinancing risk. Turning to page 16, we're pleased to report operating cash flows from total operations of just over $650 million. This result highlights the improved EBITDA performance and disciplined management of working capital. In the year, Boral received cash proceeds of $1.45 billion from the sale of our 50% interest in USG Boral and Midland Brick. As at 30 June 2021, approximately 79 million shares had been purchased via the on-market buyback for a total consideration of $507 million. Turning to our transformation program in Australia and the key drivers on page 17. Boral is targeting to achieve $200 to $250 million of transformation benefits, importantly, net of inflation. While we delivered $69 million of benefits, our initiatives are delivering on an annualized run rate benefit after inflation of $94 million against the $200 to $250 million target. Initiatives that contributed to our FY21 performance included targeted labour initiatives resulting in a 7% reduction in employee numbers, a 7% reduction in overtime hours, and a 17% reduction in contractor hours. Procurement initiatives to lower costs and help offset inflation. A broad range of improvement projects to improve operations excellence, including our National Quarry Performance Improvement Program to lift overall equipment effectiveness and other efficiency initiatives. We also closed 17 underutilised sites or plants. The introduction of the new operating model, including centralisation of functional support services and the elimination of duplication, is largely complete. The new operating model will deliver more substantial benefits in FY22. We undertook a variety of supply chain initiatives in delivering improved productivity of tippers, tankers and concrete edges. Delivery of the transformation plan will be ROFE accretive. Turning to capital expenditure on page 18, CapEx of $184 million in continuing operation, which includes leases, was down from $249 million in the prior year. It's important to highlight that we consider lease additions to be a capital expenditure. Leasing is considered a funding decision. As we outlined at the half year, our presentation of capital expenditure includes both purchased and leased assets. Capital invested included investments in the Port of Geelong Clinker Import Terminal in Victoria and the Fly Ash Classifier Plant at the Tarong Power Station. Capital expenditure for FY22 is forecast to be around $300 million. Moving to page 19, maintaining a disciplined approach to capital allocation is Boral's key priority. At this point, the group does not have surplus capital, having completed the on-market buyback in July. The receipt of proceeds from the sale of North American building product business, our interest in Meridian Brick, and the Australian building products business, together with free cash flow generated in FY22, will result in significant surplus capital. Subject to other accretive in reinvestment opportunities, surplus capital will be available for distribution to shareholders. The form of any return will consider the availability of franking credits, the prevailing share price, and the best interests of shareholders as a whole. Now let me hand you back to Flecker.
Thanks, Tino. If we move to slide 21, I'd like to talk a little bit about Boral's strategy and priorities. In the last 12 months, we've made significant progress to refocus Boral's portfolio of businesses. We completed our portfolio review in late 2020, and in May of this year, we finalised work on a comprehensive strategic framework. As I said earlier, the four pillars of that strategy are focus, position, redefine, and extend. We're already well advanced on the first and second pillars of this framework. We move to slide 22, I'll elaborate. Our priority has been to focus Boral's portfolio and unlock value. As I said at the outset, we've made significant progress to transform Boral and reset our portfolio with the divestment or expected divestment of several non-core businesses. In Australia, our continuing operations are now focused on construction materials. The second pillar of our strategy is to position our core construction materials business for improved profitability and to deliver its competitive advantage in the short, medium and longer term. Central to our success will be three key elements. Firstly, our new operating model. It's seen Boral move from an autonomous regional model to an integrated operating company organised along national product lines. The change is creating a more nimble and much more responsive company. Secondly, we're delivering on our transformation target, which will be pivotal in positioning our construction materials business to deliver a ROFE greater than WACC throughout the cycle, as Tino explained. This objective is underpinned by our $200 to $250 million EBIT transformation target by 2025. Permanent cost reductions, new earning streams, and optimising our use of funds employed will all contribute to this target. Finally, there's a significant opportunity to realise latent value within the existing property portfolio. Our surplus property portfolio represents a market value of at least $850 million. This is part of the strategy that's currently under development and is expected to be finalised in the current financial year. If we move to the next slide, the third pillar of our strategy is to redefine the company. For me, this is probably the most exciting part of the strategy and critical to how we reposition Boral for the future. We're doing this through decarbonisation plans. We're growing our recycling business and we're accelerating the rollout of our proprietary low-carbon concrete products. I'll talk more about the decarbonisation pathway in a moment, but Boral is the first company in the cement sector to set science-based targets aligned with the 1.5 degrees Celsius pathway for Scope 1 and 2 emissions. Boral also intends to join the Science-Based Targets Initiative Business Ambition for 1.5 degrees Celsius. We have external funding and partnerships in place to supplement our own research and development. Our innovation team, which is leading the way in developing high-performing, sustainable products and solutions, is further supported by a strategic partnership through the UTS Boral Centre for Sustainable Building. We've also secured funding from the federal government's CCUS Development Fund towards a pilot-scale carbon capture and use project at our Berrima kiln here in the Southern Highlands. Turning to slide 24, the diagram on this chart represents our new comprehensive sustainability framework. Our framework brings together 17 priority areas across four focus groups of people, operations, products and performance. Our materiality assessment process has supported this to ensure we're addressing the issues that our stakeholders see as being most important to Boral. These streams of work will create clearer direction and focus for all of our people. Our sustainability report will be published in mid-September and we'll expand on this. But today I want to focus on the decarbonisation pathway as a priority. We move to the next slide. As I said, we've set targets aligned with the most ambitious aim of the Paris Agreement to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. We've outlined what this translates to for our Scope 1, Scope 2 and Scope 3 emissions. We're aiming to achieve net zero emissions earlier than 2050. On our current projections, our decarbonisation pathway translates to a commitment to reduce our Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions by 18% by 2025 and by 46% by 2030. However, beyond 2030, emission reduction depends on further development and commercial viability of emerging and new technologies that we're trialling and working on. We're also targeting a reduction in our Scope 3 emissions, which is aligned with the SBTI's business ambition for 1.5 degrees Celsius methodology. For us, this translates to a reduction of 22% per tonne of cementitious materials produced by 2030. We're aligning the SBTI methodology and will explore SBTI validation of our 2030 carbon reduction targets. As I mentioned, Boral's the first company in the cement sector globally to set science-based targets aligned with that 1.5 degrees Celsius pathway for both Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. As we're showing on slide 26, we've developed detailed plans on how we will reduce carbon intensity at Boral. There are five levers that underpin Boral's climate targets and decarbonisation pathway. For energy, we'll be increasing the use of alternative fuels at the Berrima cement kiln, transitioning to 100% renewable electricity by 2025 across other operations, and delivering improvements in energy efficiency more broadly. For cementitious intensity, we're working on how best to optimise kiln feed at Berrima and accelerate the adoption of our leading low-carbon concrete product range, including Envisia, Envirocrete, and Envirocrete Plus. For transport, we intend to optimise our supply chain logistics and routes and explore fleet options utilising alternative fuels. We also intend to prioritise low-carbon intensity suppliers. And finally, we intend to explore and test emerging carbon capture and use and storage technologies. And we will remain disciplined in our investment approach when it comes to exploring those new technologies. If we move now to slide 27. As we complete divestments in the coming months, Boral will be very different to the company I first joined as CEO just over a year ago. To reflect this, the composition, scale and focus of Boral's executive committee and broader leadership team is necessarily going to have to change. Boral's new executive committee will see us operating efficiently as a single integrated leadership group with the Australian operations team working together to deliver our strategy. We have strong capability, including new leadership roles in major projects, recycling, and sales and marketing. We're working to build greater alignment with more consistent approaches across the company. Importantly, the new structure will also support a needed improvement in the experience our customers have when dealing with Boral. Our changed organisation means that we no longer require divisional CEOs. As a result, Wayne Manners' position as President and CEO of Boral Australia will cease to exist. Wayne has agreed to move into the newly created role of Chief Operating Officer on an interim basis until we've made a permanent appointment to that position. This change is effective immediately, and as a result, all customer-facing executive general manager roles will report directly to me. The COO role, which will be Sydney-based and part of the executive committee, will be responsible for assets and product solutions, supply chain and logistics, health, safety and environment, innovation and operational excellence. As a result of the new structure and streamlining activities to focus on Australia, we're also farewelling Ross Harper, whose role as Group President, HSC, Sustainability, Innovation and Ops Excellence has been made redundant. Ross, who's already left Boral, has made a significant contribution to Boral over the past 15 years, particularly to our cement business and our innovation activities. He's highly regarded across the construction materials industry, and we wish Ross all the best. Darren Schultz's role as President and CEO of Boral North America will continue until portfolio actions are complete, and Darren remains on the Executive Committee until that time. Kylie Fitzgerald's role as Group Investor Relations and Communications Director, which has had global responsibility, will also be made redundant as a result of the portfolio realignment and a change to Boral's investor relations function. Many of you on the call will have worked with Kylie over the years, and she'll remain in that role until November. I look forward to sharing more about our strategy with you in the future, and I'm really excited about the opportunity for Boral to deliver outstanding performance as we execute on our plans. We've got great assets, we've got leading positions and innovative products, backed by great people with pride in what they do. On that note, let me now turn to our outlook for FY22 on slide 29. While we saw really positive signs of improved demand at the end of FY21 and into the early stages of FY22, the new financial year has really started with pandemic-related lockdowns and unprecedented impacts on construction activity. Infrastructure activity, particularly in road construction, is expected to improve slightly in the second half of FY22, but more so moving into FY23. In the month of July alone, the construction industry lockdowns in Greater Sydney and South Australia had an estimated negative EBIT impact of $16 million on our business. Further impacts are continuing in the first quarter of FY22 in Greater Sydney due to local government area closures, together with restrictions in other states and a slow ramp up of activity in South Australia. At this stage, the impact of COVID disruptions in the first quarter may be in the order of about $50 million negative impact to earnings. Where we can, we're taking actions to minimise the financial impacts of COVID-related restrictions, including short-term cost measures. Our focus is on providing confidence in the construction sector and doing what we can do to ensure our people remain safe and interactions with customers are done in a way that protects everybody. Over and above underlying infrastructure activity, which should strengthen, we expect that FY22 market conditions will be mixed. Non-residential activity is expected to be broadly steady. Multi-residential activity is expected to remain weak, with a lift in activity not expected until immigration returns. Continued flow through of stimulus-led detached housing activity is expected. However, lead indicators suggest the softening of demand will occur later in the year. Our ability to recover lost volumes remains unclear. Therefore, we're focusing on what we can control in our business, including targeting a further $60 to $75 million of net transformation benefits in 22, which will further contribute to the longer-term $200 to $250 million transformation target, against which we've already delivered $75 million in 21. In FY22, there are no significant property sales currently contemplated, but we'll obviously update the market if an opportunity arises that we think is worth pursuing. And finally, we've provided some detail on Boral's financing costs and capital expenditure. On that note, we're now happy to take questions.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star then two. And if on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Our first question is from Lisa Hoon of Citi. Please go ahead.
Hi, morning, Zlatko. Morning, Tino. Thanks for taking my question. I guess, firstly, in terms of the earnings impact you've outlined so far from the lockdowns, can you just give us some extra colour on how much volumes were down by in July and also kind of where you're seeing higher costs? So just kind of wanted to get a sense of what the downside or upside risk to the $50 million impact in the first quarter may be.
Yeah, look, it's quite variable, Lisa. So if you think about the impact in July, it was really the construction shutdown that occurred in Greater Sydney and the shutdown that occurred in South Australia. What we're seeing into August is, frankly, that it's more broad-based. So despite the fact that construction reopened after a week or so in South Australia, the ramp-up of activity has been quite slow. And frankly, that's to be expected because construction is easy to stop, but it takes time to then ramp up as you try to get trades organised again, supply chains need to open, et cetera, et cetera. So we're seeing some lingering impacts in South Australia as they're opening. And frankly, in Greater Sydney, we're continuing to see implications despite the fact that construction has reopened. You know, the restrictions that we're all working against, the limitations, particularly of impact that local government areas are working their way through the system. And I won't quote exactly what we're seeing across different products, but that remains an impact that we're feeling today, right across particularly Greater Sydney, but even in regional areas in New South Wales. If you then go to other markets, so for example, you've seen restrictions reintroduced into construction in Victoria, which previously last year were only in the metropolitan area, but have been expanded right across the state now. As we saw last year, that is placing restrictions on the ability of our customers to execute work effectively. And in some cases, they are continuing with construction activity, albeit at reduced productivity rates. And in some cases, they've chosen to cease production altogether. So, you know, what we saw in July, Lisa, I'd say, was more of a Greater Sydney, South Australia impact. What we're seeing in August is much more broad-based. And frankly, I suspect we're going to see continued impacts, particularly in the East Coast states, through to the end of Q1 in particular.
Okay, so and then I guess thanks. That's good color, Zlatko. Also in terms of the balance sheet, you know, just given the wave of surplus capital that's expected next year, I know you've kind of given us CapEx guidance for 22, but can you just talk about whether you see any opportunities in the domestic business for any major reinvestment to step up, or are you kind of happy with the asset base as it is?
Yeah, I think we're being really thoughtful, Lisa, about where we reinvest in the business. And Tino touched on this in his prepared remarks. But look, we have a lot of fleet assets. So whether it's heavy mobile equipment or, you know, transport on the road equipment, you know, we regularly look at upgrading that equipment when it's at a point in its life cycle where it needs to be updated. So we're always going to have a level of reinvestment as we renew that fleet. We don't currently see any major investment required in any of our quarries. But we are thinking about the network positions we have, particularly in key metropolitan areas. So we've done a lot of work more recently about the network for batch plants, concrete batch plants, particularly in Sydney, and we're expanding that to other geographies. That is identifying that there are some small opportunities, you know, think single-digit millions, to reframe that network so that we have really strong positions in markets where we think there are good, strong growth corridors. In some cases, that means we'll sell surplus properties or surplus positions we've currently got, like we did with Alexandria. But we're also conscious we continue to need to move that network around so we're well positioned to pick up volumes. As part of that work, we'll obviously also think about, you know, future land acquisitions that we might need, and particularly in those growth corridors. So sitting here today, I'm not seeing any material future investment that's required. Yeah, we've got the Geelong clinker plant that Tino described, which is coming to the end of phase one of construction. We've got the Terang fly ash project that we're finalising at the moment. They were quite substantial projects, but there's nothing really large of that magnitude that we're currently at a point where we want to commission in the short term.
Sure, thanks. That's good colour. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Our next question is from Simon Thackray of Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good morning, Zlatko. Good morning, Tino. I appreciate your time. Notwithstanding your comments on sectoral exposure to roads, et cetera, I would have expected a very large construction materials player would have had a bit more balance across the portfolio and a bit more flexibility to participate in some of the different segments. How do you think your new national strategy is going to facilitate this flexibility so you don't get you know, potentially stuck in an industry segment that turns against you, you know, as rapidly as it has, let's say, in major projects in New South Wales and Queensland?
No, it's a great question, Simon. And frankly, we're still at the front end of the new operating model and the new structure that we've got. But I've got to say, the leaders, the executive general managers, we're putting those roles, the way they're working together, the way they're thinking about opportunities, it's light years ahead of where we were even 12 months ago. And just to give you a quick example, which I don't think we would have seen in the prior approach, you know, which was much more focused on optimising within a region. You know, when we first saw the lockdowns happening in Greater Sydney, our new head of Ashbelt, Rob McGuire, you know, he was straight on the ball and thinking about, well, how do we redeploy our Ashbelt crews? If they're unable to work in Greater Sydney, where else can we move them to? And that kind of nimbleness is, you know, ideally what we'd expect going forward. But frankly, when you've had the amount of exposure to roads, highways, subdivisions and bridges we've had, or other engineering work, to pivot into, you know, segments like residential very, very quickly is going to be limited. I'm pleased with the volumes we've picked up, particularly in detached housing around concrete and other elements, but, you know, we're not going to be able to pivot as quickly as we might have liked, considering the positions we've had in different segments and in different geographies.
Okay, that's helpful, Zacho. So that's probably going to bring me to my next question. So against the numbers that you've delivered at the EBIT line, I've got a nagging question in my head on corporate overhead allocation now that the North American business and the Australian building products businesses are classified in their entirety as discontinued operations. So if I'm looking at the Australian second half underlying result, is there any element of a reallocation of allocated corporate overhead to the Australian business in this delivered EBIT in the second half?
I'll give Tino a chance just to answer that as well, Simon, but I might just jump in first and talk about the approach we're taking. So as you would imagine, through the work that we're doing, not only on the strategy but on transformation, we're pulling apart not only corporate costs but overheads that have historically sat within the Australian business, as well as the operating performance of those businesses. So there's not a cost element within the group that's not being tackled, and Tino will elaborate on it, but yeah, we've already delivered what I think are quite substantial cost reductions in what was traditionally called corporate costs in FY21, and there's more to go in that space as well. But Tino, you might elaborate based on the work we're doing.
Yeah, just to be clear, Simon, there's none of that which you alluded to. If there's US costs coming back, that doesn't exist. We were actually, it's about $14 million in each half, so you don't need to be concerned about that. In fact, one of the opportunities moving forward is where we have the Innovation Factory in the US, which those costs were reported centrally. That's going to allow us to consolidate in Australia and get some cost savings, which will contribute to the transformation program going forward. Separately, we are considering, and Slacko's already highlighted some of those in terms of what it means for functional areas and how we align the corporate structure to what is a smaller regional play rather than a global business going forward. So you
sure,
should that
sure.
will be in transformation benefits going forward.
No, sure. I saw the corporate costs were flat half on half. I was more saying, was there an allocation that's come from the US to the Australian division,
no,
given the
no.
EBIT performance. So that's organic, that EBIT performance in the second half. Okay, and then just as the final question and as wrapping the first two up, if I'm looking forward now, you know, what you basically, on a normalised basis, adding back the impacts from FY20, you're saying there was a $101 million EBIT hit from volume and $29 million from mix and price in FY21 against your transformation benefits. What, when you look forward to the cycle, what is the assessment of mid-cycle EBIT for Australia now, excluding property?
Oh, I think...
what's the potential for the business?
Well, I'll talk about, you know, I thought that FY20 was bottom of the cycle, and that's the way we set the transformation program, as you know. And then this year, we've had some more difficult conditions in terms of volumes. So I don't really think it's worth speculating on what mid-cycle earnings are, rather what's in our control. And what we have said is the transformation program needs to deliver between $200 and $250 million going forward. And we believe that that's going to put us in good stead to ride the cycle on the upswing and get the operating leverage that this business will need. And if you just look at how that's structured, so if we were to achieve the 200 to 250 million, even off this year's results, which and backing out the one-offs, you're kind of getting into earnings above 12% to 14% or 14.5% at 200 to 250 in terms of ROFE returns. So that's a good position to be at bottom of the cycle. Question is, will that be the bottom of the cycle, or remains to be seen? But either way, it's going to be it's going to hold us in good stead. And I would say that, you know, when we do look at the pipeline going forward, you know, we have said towards the second half of this year and probably more heading into 23, we're feeling quite good about the pipeline of work that's out there. But look, I might leave it to Slacko if he wants to comment on what mid-cycle earnings will be. But
well, we're not going to provide that kind of guidance, Lyman. But the one thing I would say was, look, I think we're all focused on getting the right health outcomes through COVID and what happened in lockdowns. But look, it hit us at an unfortunate time, because as I said, we were seeing quite good volumes in the fourth quarter of FY21. It was one of the strongest quarters we've had for quite some time. And heading into the start of 22, we're really positive about volumes in the first couple of weeks. And then you saw the impact of lockdowns and construction hits. So as Tino said, I'd love to see, you know, what this operating leverage that we believe in the business could look like when we've got some tailwinds with some volumes. Unfortunately, we're not in that situation where we're seeing that at the moment. We'd love to see some volume pick up in the second half of the year, particularly out of infrastructure as that pipeline finally hits the ground. But I think we're going to have to wait probably until at least the second quarter or into the second half before we see that starting to play out.
Okay. And I'm just surprised that you saw good volumes in the fourth quarter with the delivery of that EBIT number. But does this have any implications, Tino, from the rating agencies, you know, given their S&P, the negative watch on the 9th of July? Does it have any implications in discussions with them, the outlook that you're providing, notwithstanding the amount of cash that's coming in?
I don't think so. Look, the rating agencies and what they do is up to them. What we continue to do is manage the business in a disciplined way, manage the balance sheet. The financial framework talks about the way we think about our net debt position and our ability to service our future debt obligations. And, you know, what the rating agencies have said is that they're very comfortable with our financial framework. They do believe it's disciplined. They like the fact that we target the bottom end of the net debt range, which gives us flexibility, especially at times like we're facing right now. So ultimately, we're going to do the right thing, which is keep a strong balance sheet as we ride through this, because we do believe that that will be a source of competitive advantage for us. It gives us the ability to ride the headwinds and then take advantage of the tailwinds when they're there. So look, I'm not going to comment on what the rating agencies themselves are going to do, though, but other than to say they're supportive of the financial framework.
Okay, terrific. Thanks for your time, guys.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.
Our next question is from Andrew Scott of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, gents. There's like kind of a question for you. I think this reporting season, supply chain, cost of freight, shipping, et cetera, has been a key topic, and that's obviously very relevant, at least at the upstream sort of cement part of the business. So just interested how you're seeing that playing out in your business, number one. How you think it changed your competitive position, given that you do have domestic cement manufacturing here? And thirdly, I understand that there was some cost increases out there from competitors basically passing on some of those higher shipping costs. Did you have any intention, or do you have any intention to raise prices as well in that space, albeit it might be thwarted by the lockdown somewhat?
Yeah, let me deal with the second part of your question first, Andrew. We've said this a few times. Everybody keeps saying that we're kind of slow on the price lever and we're not disciplined. Frankly, when you see the market conditions that we've seen over the last couple of years, we're not expecting a strong pricing environment. What is pleasing for us, though, is we saw a stabilisation of prices, particularly across most of our key products, during FY21. There was a step down from the prior year, but stabilisation of pricing within the year, and frankly, good momentum into the start of FY22. So we went out in April with price increases, and we're getting reasonable traction when you, as you said, when you consider the environment we're in at the moment. So I feel good about that, some of those prices, but the market context is still not robust enough where, you know, we can do maybe what we did back in 17 or 18. In terms of the change in competitive position, you know, as we keep saying, I think having domestic production and particularly having a kiln in New South Wales is a competitive advantage for Boral. And when you see lack of shipping availability, the cost of shipping, importing clinker becomes much more difficult and much more costly. And frankly, if you don't have an integrated position like Boral has, that becomes a riskier proposition. So we feel good about our position. We continue to supplement our domestic production with, you know, import volumes where we think there's an opportunity to get them at the right price and into the right market segment. But our position in Berrima is outstanding at the moment. And when we deliver on some of the transformation benefits down there, when we think through decarbonisation, Berrima is going to become even more important to us going forward. So I feel good about that position relative to what others are seeing that are more reliant on import. And I feel good about our ability to continue to drive that competitive advantage going forward for it to be a differentiator versus particularly some of the smaller independents who are importing their own volumes.
Thank you, Zlatko. Tino, question for you. I may be reading too much into this, but just, you know, no dividend paid this period. I take it, you know, understand that the cash from the US sale hasn't come through yet, but just reading the commentary, it feels to me there's maybe a greater importance on frank dividends, and maybe that takes precedence over something like a buyback. Am I reading too much into that, or is that something that's maybe coming to fruition as a result of the change of the overall group ownership?
Yeah, no, you're probably reading too much into that. So I think what the way to think about it, our framework is pretty clear on this. We remain focused on generating surpluses. So that's the first step. Where we got surplus, we then go through an assessment of what's the best way to get that back to our shareholders. Sometimes it's going to be buyback, depending on what the share price is doing relative to what we see in intrinsic value. It could be a capital return, and it could be a franked dividend. We sort of acknowledge that, you know, franking credits in our hands are of no use, and they're worth more in the hands of shareholders. So if we have those, you kind of got this predisposition to want to get the benefit of that back to shareholders. But we don't have a lot of franking credits right now, so that's not something that's troubling us right now as well. But we don't have a payout ratio or anything like that. You shouldn't think about it that way. We certainly don't think about it that way. That would be inconsistent with our financial framework if we did have a payout ratio or anything like that. So first step, is there surplus? Today there's not. We're at the bottom end of the debt range. Clearly, it'll come once we've received the proceeds. And we did the same thing when we sold USG Boral. We waited for the proceeds to come in. That delivered the surplus, and then we dealt with that surplus in the most efficient way. Ultimately, it'll be a decision for the board as to what that is, but that's going to be the way management put forward a recommendation to the board is in line with the approach that I've just articulated.
Thank you. And just very quickly, the Australian building products assets outside of timber, the ones that are yet to be sold, could you just give us an idea of book value and what they generated in 21?
Yeah, so not material in terms of book value. So we expect to sell those this year, and there's no material gain or loss that's expected on those. In terms of building materials or building products for the year, in total, I think they contributed about $16, $17 million to EBIT.
Yeah, I think it was 18. I was just wondering if we could strip timber out from the two that you still actually own at the moment.
No, if we haven't disclosed that, then no, we can't.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Our next question is from Peter Steyn of Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Hi, Zlatko and Tina. Thanks for your time. If I may, just following on a little around capital distributions, just curious how you're thinking about timing. Obviously, it's a bit premature to be talking about fly ash proceeds or Flash related proceeds. But if you thought about the second half of your year as the times that you'd be receiving inflows from asset sales, are you going to, or how would you think about capital return timing in relation to those events? Is it an as and when, or do you rather think about transitioning that capital out at a single juncture?
No, I think once we've got that surplus capital, and I'll allow Tino in a moment just to jump in, Peter, but as we do with USG Boral, when we completed that transaction, when we received the proceeds, we came out straight away and declared what we're going to do with that surplus capital, and that was a buyback in that instance. Now, as you would assume, we're consistently working in the background and consulting with the board about the myriad of options we've gotten, as Tino outlined. It could be a franked dividend, could be a capital return, could be a subsequent buyback. We're looking at all of that, those options, and when we do receive the proceeds, we'll make those decisions at that time. We're not going to wait for all of the transactions to be completed. We'll obviously contemplate what the impact of those subsequent transactions to close could be on it, but there's no need for us to wait. But Tino, you might just share your thoughts.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, surplus is surplus. If it's surplus to requirements and we've determined it so, then it should go, but we need to wait till we get it. In terms of timing, I think we've given indication of when we expect the building products transaction to close later in this half year. We haven't said anything about Flash. It's premature to be talking about that. And Meridian Brick we expect by the end of the quarter. That sort of gets you into that time when it kind of makes sense if we're doing anything other than a dividend, where you're going to require shareholder approvals. We've got an AGM in October, so it'd be likely that there'd be greater clarity at that point. It's kind of the way we're thinking about it. Logically makes sense.
Perfect. Thanks, Tino. Appreciate the colour. And then, if I may, just sort of a little bit of a strategic longer-term question in relation to your ambitions around decarbonisation and the product set that you're looking to make more of. I guess those products have been around a little while. You've also seen a lot of your global competitors really step up the ante in this space as well. How do you think about developing a particularly distinct competitive advantage in that product set that sets you apart? And then how do you think about your ability to generate returns? Does it not become a commoditized product set very quickly in time?
Yeah, that's a great question, Peter. Look, our low carbon concrete strategy is really important to the way we want to move forward. And frankly, and you'd expect me to say this, I think that our Envisia product, which has the higher performance capabilities, is one of the best low-carbon concretes anywhere in the world. So I know that might sound weird. It's a little Boral down in Australia to have one of the best LCCs, but when we pull apart the offerings from other competitors and look at the performance characteristics of their offering versus Envisia as an example, we feel really good. We've also got EnviroCrete Plus that we've only introduced more recently, and we've got EnviroCrete, which is probably the lower performing, lower spec requirements for more general applications. So when you talk about some of these being around for a while, look, Envisia's been in the market for a while, Peter, you're absolutely right on that case. It's been used in projects like Crown Casino and Barangaroo, it's been used at a soak house in Melbourne. But there are two things to keep in mind here. One is it takes a number of years for a new concrete to be in place before some of the more conservative customers or users will be willing to start to specify it in projects. So if you think about various transport departments and state governments, they tend to want to see 5 or 7 years of history of a product before they're willing to open their doors and contemplate it. We're now at that point. We've got 5 years of history of Envisia being used, and we can show how it performs over an extended period of time. So to some degree, that kind of time frame is expected. I would also point that, we also kicked a couple of own goals. When we created Envisia, we thought we created Google, and we went out to the market and tried to charge a significant premium on pricing. Now, it's a great product. It performs really well. particularly in high rise, you know, the strength and performance capabilities, you know, deliver significant benefits for building companies. But when you start to charge a premium of the order of what we did, you're not going to get a lot of traction. So in the last 12 months in particular, we've pulled back and said, how do we position Envisia, Envirocrete and Envirocrete Plus to the segments that would get the most benefit out of the performance capabilities of those products, including, you know, the green characteristics of cement replacement? And then how do we position pricing appropriately? And we're not going to be looking for a 15-20% premium. So I feel really good about our understanding of those LCCs and the opportunity ahead of us, Peter. But there's a couple of reasons why traction hasn't been strong over the last couple of years, but we're poised to see quite fast penetration going forward based on the segments and the work that we've done.
Thanks, Latko. Appreciate that. That was a great response. Leave it there. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter.
Our next question is from Daniel Kang of CLSA Australia. Please go ahead.
Morning, everyone. A question for Tino first, and probably an extension of Simon's question. So I'm just looking at slide 4 on EBIT excluding property of 157 mil. Are you able to confirm the equivalent first half number? And maybe I've missed this, I'm sorry, but the equivalent EBIT in your first half presentation was 111 mil. So I'm sure this includes obviously discontinued EBIT, but just wanting to work out the first half equivalent of the 157.
Yeah. So 111 was the first half EBIT for the Australian operations. It will have included Australian building products.
Right.
I haven't got that number off the top of my head what that is, but you would need to reduce that. But there was still a significant decline when you adjust for that between first half and second half. A couple of things to take into account for why that was. A couple of things is the kiln outage that we had at Berrima was in the second half. The legal fees, which we called out in our bridge on page 11, were predominantly in the second half as well. And the first half did include quite profitable projects that came to an end, including projects like Norfolk Island in the first half of last year. And then what we saw when we were entering the second half, particularly that December, January was a really weird time where we saw a lot of demand coming through in December and then a real slowdown in January as people went on holidays. And then the last is the impact of the pricing, where the lows in pricing, if you're looking at it on a comparative basis, occurred in the second half where they've now stabilised. That's just a bit of colour on the move, but there was a move definitely.
Oh, thanks, Tino. That's a little bit clearer. And just on slide 11 on your waterfall chart, your cost inflation of 50 mil. Can you talk us through the areas of inflation that you're seeing? Are you expecting a similar level of inflation this year? Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, for planning purposes, yeah, we're planning a similar level of inflation, but obviously anything that we can do through strategic sourcing or whatever to reduce inflation in the business will benefit our transformation targets as well. But the way you should think about that 50 million in FY21, it's around about a third labour, a third material, and a third is just other areas. A third, a third, a third.
Okay. And just a final one to Zlatko, if I may. Congratulations on committing to your net zero target by 2050. Are you expecting a meaningful increase in investment to drive this decarbonisation process?
No, we're not, Daniel. There obviously will be some level of investment. So, for example, and it's on the slide that we shared on 26, you think about the pathways of how we're going to reduce carbon, particularly at our Berrima facility, thinking through how we, and energy is one element of that. So we already use refuse-derived fuel as part of the fuel mix down there. we're limited in how much of that refuse-derived fuel we can use because today we can't accept plastics and some other products. We are implementing what's called a chlorine bypass capital investment, and it's not material. You should think about it, less than $20 million. But it's economic today because it then allows us to take additional streams of waste product that we can burn there as part of the fuel mix. So there will be elements like that where we do require a little bit of capital. But frankly, some of the longer term opportunities, like potentially using hydrogen or thinking through carbon capture, we're right at the front end and we don't yet have specificity on capital around that. When we think about transportation and how we move our fleet from predominantly diesel to potentially alternative fuels, we'll obviously coordinate that in a way where, as we get to the point where we're renewing the fleet, then we'll renew it with the more low-carbon opportunities that we've got. So it won't be incremental. It'll just be phased in the way that we normally phase the rollout of old equipment. So I don't think it's going to be material. There will be a little bit of CapEx, but frankly, the visibility we've got on CapEx through to 2030, all of those projects are economic, even excluding a notional carbon tax or impost like that.
Thank you, Parker. Thank you,
Daniel. Daniel, can I just help clarify a bit on that 111 bridge you were doing as well? So when you look at that 111 that we did in the first half, that didn't include corporate, whereas the 157 that we've outlined on the bridge in page 11 here does include corporate. So you just need to adjust for the $14 million of corporate in the first half as well. So if you adjust for that, then adjust for building products. There's still a difference, but it's less meaningful.
Thanks for that, Tina.
No worries, Dan.
This is from Keith Chow of MST Marquee. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Tina and Slacker. Slacker, just first question on the Australian business, reflecting on the operations just been. So I take your point around major projects revenues having declined quite significantly, and you know, looking at the back out based on the percentages disclosed, I think that fell from about $530 million of revenue to $292 million, with a corresponding EBIT impact of $40 million. So if you stripped out the major projects, the balance of the business revenues were actually up slightly at 1.7%. So take your point around mix changes in products, which we shouldn't see in the volume impact anyway, and differences in state drivers from a regional perspective. But can you just help me understand, outside of the major projects, that $37 million impact from volumes on EBIT, how does that materialise when your revenues are actually up slightly, ex major projects?
And that's where you get the mix impact really coming through, Keith. So, look, as I said, we were really pleased to see the positivity in detached housing, and we've seen that flow through into our concrete volumes going to detached housing, which were double-digit growth, and we feel really good about that traction. Unfortunately, what you then see is, what you tend to get is differential earnings on detached housing versus, for example, multi-residential and particularly high-rise. Because when you get into high-rise, whether it's an office building or even a residential building, productivity for the building company is really important. And they will tend to pay more of a premium to ensure that they can get product when they need it that gives them the productivity to build the building they need. So you end up with a bit of a mixed impact. So although detached was really good for us, the drop-off in multi-residential more than offset that. Equally, when you look at non-residential, you have projects like shopping centres, office buildings, because of that focus on productivity and speed to finalisation, they tend to be, you know, well-returning projects for us. But you've seen that go backwards, and particularly off the back of office buildings and what's happened with shopping centres. We'd like to think that there will be some stimulus that might drive, you know, further schools or aged care facilities. But that mix is what you're seeing come through in the earnings relative to what's coming through in revenue.
So, Slack, I would have thought the price mix issue would have been captured in the $29 million decline in EBIT that was outlined in the waterfall chart on slide 11 rather than the impact from volume in itself.
Well, Tino, you might just want to elaborate exactly how we're capturing those differential impacts in that waterfall.
Yeah, so the waterfall tried to capture the impact. Well, and we got the feedback at the half year that the impact of COVID in prior year and the flood and bushfires, we would expect to see those coming back in here as a tailwind in FY21. So that's what this waterfall tries to show, that those did in fact provide a tailwind. It's just that the activity levels were substantially down, when you adjust for those impacts from FY20 into FY21, and that's what we've tried to do there. Over the page, on the page 12, we've tried to give you a bit of colour as to what's happened between the major projects and whatnot to arrive at the 77 million net impact on volume. Apart from that, we haven't provided more colour. I'm not sure I really understand your question, Keith, but I'm happy to take it offline and see if I can help you out and point you to stuff. But I didn't really understand the question.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you back out major projects, the revenue line was, call it, flat for Boral Australia. Yet you've still got a $37 million impact on EBIT from volumes, ex major projects. So it just seems a bit odd to me that your EBIT can fall as much as it has when revenues have remained flat, ex major projects.
That's not what I'm seeing. So, well, I'll need to take that one offline, Keith.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that, certainly. The second thing, maybe a question for you, Tino. I think when the North America Building Products transaction was announced, I think Boral was applying to the ATO for a bit of tax relief in order to return some of those proceeds to shareholders when they do come through. Just wondering if you can give us an update on whether you've had those discussions with the ATO, whether there's any more colour on what quantum of proceeds can be returned without a tax consequence attached to them?
No, there's no colour I can give you right now, Keith. So we will go through that process once we've got the cash, and we'll talk to the ATO based on something that we're proposing. They don't really sit there and talk about speculative stuff and give you views on stuff. So we would need to get the proceeds, work out what the appropriate form to get those surplus back to shareholders, take into account circumstances at the time, and then have those conversations with the ATO. Of course, we've got a view on what they are, on what that treatment would be. We've been given some thought to this, but that's not something I'm wanting to share at this point in time.
Okay, that's fair enough. And then just one on capital allocation. I think most of the discussion today is centred around returning cash or surplus cash to shareholders. Can we take it that M&A is now off the cards for Boral in the near to medium term?
I wouldn't say it's off the cards, Keith, but it's not a big priority for us, frankly. I think what we said back in February was, you know, we have identified gaps in our vertically integrated position in a couple of geographies. You know, if assets or businesses were to come to market that fill in those vertical integrations positions for us, we'll definitely have a look at them. But we're not out there looking for any large transformational transactions at the moment. We just don't see value in that. And we focus, frankly, on driving this business as hard as we can internally. We've got a lot of organic opportunities to improve earnings.
And so, Slako, can I take it that if Boral was to pursue M&A, it wouldn't necessarily be in more traditional heavy construction materials manufacturing businesses that are carbon intensive, particularly under the decarbonisation framework that the company has implemented?
Well, I think we would look at those if we felt we could drive decarbonisation as part of the value creation story, Keith. So, for example, you know, if somebody wanted to sell a batch plant where we thought it fits with our network, we'd have a look at buying it. We'd implement the pathway to decarbonise that we're doing right across our portfolio. Similarly, if there was a quarry in a great location and we think we could add value through how we optimise our network, then we would definitely pick that up and implement our results. So those decisions aren't going to be driven by opportunities to decarbonise, but it'll definitely be a feature of how we think about it. I just don't see any large transformational activities or opportunities out there that are really a fit for us at the moment.
Yeah, so it sounds like quarrying concrete might be, you know, some marginal things going on there from an acquisition perspective, but cement or materials of the like are probably off the table.
Yeah, look, I think we're happy with our cement position. We're obviously, we like what we've got in Berrima. We like the opportunity to really improve performance out of Berrima. And we've got some import positions, as you guys know, in both Geelong and SEQ. So, you know, we'll continuously think about, are there additional positions that we need to keep to build just to supplement that? But frankly, yeah, I don't feel the need to go and buy somebody else's position at the moment. We can do that organically if we feel we need to.
That's great. Thanks very much, Slatko and Tino.
Thanks, Jess.
Thank you. A reminder to ask a question, please press star then one. Our next question is from Peter Wilson of Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you. So just to follow that question on major projects, there seems to have been a change in the way you're classifying the major project revenue. In this result, you said that it was 17% in the prior year. If you go back to last year's report, it was 13%. So I'm just keen to understand what the change in classification is, given the importance to that EBIT waterfall, that volume waterfall.
Oh, look, I think we're going to have to go back and just confirm that, Peter. There hasn't been any substantive change in how we think about major projects. You know, the definition, the criteria, the value still remains the same. So we'll just need to come back and ensure what we reported last year is definitely consistent with this year. But I'm not aware that we've made any changes in that classification.
No, nor are I.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be good if you could come back there. If I could ask on the asphalt business, like revenues down close to 20% in the second half. When I look at that business, can you give us an idea of how much of the volumes in that business, I guess, as of the FY21 level, how much of the volumes are major project related versus maintenance type volumes? I'm just trying to get a feel for how depressed that business is and what the potential downside could be from here.
Well, I think if you look, so we've got positions in both new build roads as well as in maintenance, as you know, Peter. We're actually pulling apart our asphalt strategy right now. It's part of the work that we're doing on the strategy to understand exactly where do we want to play in that value chain. What's the level of activity that we see over the next 5, 10, 20 years? And how do we position ourselves to play in either that new construction or the maintenance? So, now, I'd save that for a later date when we can come back to you with a really well-articulated answer, but it's actively something that we're working on. I would say that I like the asphalt position because it gives us the opportunity to speak with infrastructure owners, asset owners, and tier one contractors, and frankly, provide a number of different alternatives. So we could be talking about concrete or we could be talking about asphalt. That's a unique offering for us, and we like the ability to pivot depending on what the customers like. I will say, though, that to a large degree, activity in asphalt is not only driven by smaller opportunities with local councils, but it's driven by activity that states drives. And you called out what happened in the second half. Frankly, our third quarter was really challenged. And it was challenged because at the start of the year, we had a bunch of COVID lockdowns or restrictions following Christmas. Activity really didn't ramp up in asphalt until February. That's quite late. A number of states, you know, didn't issue their contracts for asphalt work as quickly as they would normally. So, you know, we were geared up, we were ready to support a lot of those opportunities, and it didn't come through till February. So you can't see it, but our third quarter asphalt performance was some of the weakest that we've seen for quite a long time. Now, it picked up in the fourth quarter, but that third quarter really impacted us in a way that we hadn't anticipated at the end of last calendar year.
Okay. And as you said, I guess the review of that asphalt business will consider the, you know, the likely future opportunities for that business. When you think about infrastructure and the pipeline, so in today's outlook commentary, you push back, I guess, the uptick from in infrastructure from what was second half of this calendar year to, you know, the first half of next calendar year and maybe even into FY23. So it continues to get pushed back, which I understand is external to your business. But at what stage do you start to wind back the optimism around that pipeline, given that we're just getting, you know, pushback after pushback after pushback?
Yeah, look, I like the pipeline, and the pipeline's still there. So whilst the pipeline's still there, I feel really good about the opportunity. It's really the timing that we're trying to get our arms around. And frankly, if you have a look at our MD&A, we've got a really good list of the projects that we're not only executing on today, albeit you've seen a bit of a hiatus in FY21 as projects were completed and its new ones are slow to come in. But when you look at activity in 22, 23, and what we're currently tendering on right across the country, but particularly the East Coast, I still feel good about that. We're not seeing that pipeline of opportunity fall away. Look, there are one or two projects like Victorian Strategic Road Upgrade that was cancelled, but we're not seeing other projects cancelled. We're seeing them delayed, or in some cases, like with Westgate Tunnel and the issue around PFAS disposal, there's a key issue that needs to be solved before that project can kick on. So I'm still optimistic about the tunnel. I guess what we're trying to get our arms around is the timing of when those projects hit the ground, when they will be materials intensive, and when we will start supplying to them.
Fair enough. Okay. One last one, if I could. North America Fly Ash, could you give us an idea of the EBITDA that business produced in FY21?
No, we haven't provided that historically, Peter, and particularly considering we're in the midst of conversations with interested parties, I don't think it's appropriate to do that.
Okay, sure. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Our next question is from Lee Power of UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi, Zlatko. Hi, Tino. Just on major projects, you've called out a contraction in materials intensity from 5% down to 3% of work done. Given that the project pipeline that you've just talked to and called out on slide 38, I mean, where do you think we settle over that period 22 to 23 in terms of materials intensity?
Look, I'm not seeing anything at the moment, Lee, that changes my view for FY22. So I think it's going to be pretty similar to what we saw in FY21. And what will really drive a change in that is some of these projects that we're tendering on at the moment really kicking off and starting to use materials. So the reason we're a little bit hesitant on timing, frankly, is because some of the COVID impacts, we're just uncertain about when they're going to hit. When we spoke back in February, we talked about we're expecting a pickup in major projects, particularly Ashbelt, in the second half of this year. I've not seen anything particularly that changes our view of that, but we're being cautious because of COVID and the impact it's having right at the moment, and feasibly it could have an impact in delaying some of those projects. So I'm not really seeing a material impact in 22, but you probably see, if you do see an impact, Lee, it'll be towards the end of 22 and definitely into 23 when other projects kick off.
Okay. And then I take your comments around pricing before. I mean, just around, obviously, like-for-like prices, concrete quarries were down, but it sounds like they've stabilised into the back end of the year. I mean, I noticed that you've got pricing out there for an October price increase, 2 to 5% concrete, 3 to 8% for aggregates. Should we think about that just in the context of what you talked about in terms of your April price increase as just shoring that up and making sure that sticks, or do you expect to achieve any of that October price increase on top of what you've managed to stabilise through April?
Well, if you go back to what we did in October of last year, that was more about shoring up and providing a position. We are expecting to get traction in April. And frankly, what happens beyond this, Lee, is really going to depend on what happens in the market. If we continue to have construction restrictions or shuts like we've had over the last 4 to 5 weeks, I think the pricing environment is going to be very different. If we see the pickup in volumes like we saw in May and June into the early part of July, I think the environment around pricing is going to be quite different. But we'll have to make that call once we see how we come out of the next couple of months.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Appreciate it.
There are no further questions at this time. I'll hand the call back to Mr. Todorcevski for some closing comments.
No, thanks very much, Ari, and thanks to everybody for your interest. Obviously, if there are any further questions, come back through Kylie. We can organise a separate session or a separate briefing if there is anything particular we couldn't get to today. But thanks again for joining us.